additional cost that comes with financing is the interest. And that's why I included it on that slide deck, because the vehicle cost is what it is. The additional incremental cost is what you have to consider when you're evaluating whether or not you want to finance something or whether or not you want to pay for it cash. And the point that that previous slide was making is, yes, there is an additional interest cost that comes with lease payments, but when we compare that to the vehicles that you already own and the expensive maintenance, that delta isn't as big as you think. And a lot of people think, well, it's free and clear, I don't owe any more money on it. Well, you do. You're still maintaining that vehicle and it's still depreciating. And so it's just important to kind of think about that as you think about the decisions that you want to make regarding lease purchases. With that said, Enterprise, if we could go to the next slide, we are fine. Actually, oh, goodness, I went one slide ahead. Could you go one more slide, please, and then we'll back into this, because I think this goes along with what I just said. So Enterprise is okay if the town would prefer to pay cash up front. We're able to accommodate that. So however you want to acquire vehicles, however you want to fund vehicles, that's really a town decision. From an Enterprise decision, we're fine with whatever funding mechanism you choose to use. There are good reasons why towns, why cities choose to fund vehicles through a lease structure, but we're not married to that. And so our goal is to be a good partner of the town, to understand what the appropriate vehicles are, what the appropriate life cycle is, and help the town execute on that strategy so that you're not faced with what I see with a lot of other cities, a lot of other towns, a lot of other counties that we work with, where we see they have a huge backlog of older vehicles, and it's a real challenge for them to figure out what to do and how they can kind of like dig themselves out of that hole. So I would encourage the town, regardless of how you choose to fund vehicles, understand what the appropriate life cycle and the appropriate vehicle is. If you get those two things right, you'll cut out a majority of your fleet headaches and your fleet costs. And that's what the previous slide is intended to address. So this is an agency that we partner with. They have roughly 250 vehicles in fleet. They had an in-house garage, and so they had 10 years worth of maintenance data. And so we felt like this was a really good sample size for us to use when talking with other agencies. And so we looked at every particular cost when it comes to vehicle ownership. And I know this kind of gets into the weeds a little bit, but we evaluated a 5-year cycle versus a 10-year cycle. When you look at the first column where it says 5-year cycle, the average initial cost, that's on light duty vehicles, so everything from a compact sedan to a 3/4 ton truck was considered, and we just kind of averaged all of that out as kind of a example light duty vehicle, if that makes sense. We looked at the resale value after year 5 and the resale value after year 10. After year 5, that example vehicle was worth roughly $22,000. After year 10, that same vehicle would sell for roughly $10,000. And then you just annualize depreciation, right? So you just say, okay, what's the difference between 36 and 22? Divide that by 5. What's the difference between 36 and 10? Divide that by 10. That's your annual depreciation cost. And so when we look at it, there's not a massive change. There's not a massive delta between years 5 and years 10. Where the big numbers come is in the cost to maintain those same vehicles. As you know, vehicles really start to hit their peak in maintenance costs in those kind of older years, and that's what the numbers bear out. Again, they had 10 years worth of maintenance data, over 250 vehicles, so it was easy for us to quantify exactly what it was because we just took the total number and divided it by the number of years. All of that to say, it's counterintuitive, but if you were to own a vehicle, government fleet, you would actually be better off owning vehicle 1, years 1 through 5, vehicle 2, years 1 through 5, versus one vehicle for 10 years. That's what the data bears out. With that said, we're flexible. Our job is to come alongside the town and help you make good decisions. we defer to the town in terms of what decisions you want to make, and you give us the guidance on how to execute that, and then we execute it. That's the end of my presentation.
Well, thank you so much. I want to first speak with the council before we even start with questions of you and probably perhaps Chief Scales, I'm not sure, or a manager, I'm not sure. But I believe we have three vehicle leases that are scheduled to end at fiscal year 2025 and 2026. Two from Public Works and one is being transferred from Public Works to the fire department, right?
Yes.
So as these vehicles reach the end of their current lease terms, the first thing staff wants from us is direction on whether we're going to release those, sell, or retain these units, and then moving beyond this fiscal year, what is it we want to do with our leases as they expire? Are we going to buy out the leases? Will Enterprise help us when we need to purchase and sell? And if I believe that we would need to budget approximately $200,000 per year to replace a vehicle every 5 years, so that we would continuously have a fleet, you know, 7 maybe to 8 years. But staff is looking for instruction from us, and with that, I think, does anyone up here have any questions of Jacob?
Yes.
Please, go ahead.
And thank you. I was here.
I remember.
You guys, and I was actually a resident sitting back there.
Yeah.
The first easy question I have is, where is an engine idle meter on a vehicle?
Ooh, that's a great question.
Okay, here's why I'm asking, because,
please,
you know, I continue to hear that our police vehicles every 5 years, and you know, because of not miles, but because of engine hour. But so if you take a vehicle to an auction, and I'm not a car guy, I've got a friend of mine that buys my cars for me, and that's good. But if I was at an auction, or if I'm going to buy a car off a lot, how do I know it was a police vehicle that has, in the miles are 50,000 in Ponce Inlet?
Yeah.
How do I know? How would you know? Because I know our schedule is to replace the police vehicles every 5 years, not because of miles, but because of engine hours. I get it, but I don't get it.
I understand. So interceptors are a completely different animal than light duty fleet. Most towns, most cities replace interceptors because at 5 years they just, like, they're done. So it's not necessarily that there's a financial case to be made to replace those vehicles. It's really more about just sheer necessity. And I think what plays a lot into that is the idle time. Because especially when you think about, you know, we have the Florida sun, you have the salt, you have all of that stuff kind of weighing down on a vehicle. And then additionally, you have the vehicle idling. And so that's putting a tremendous amount of heat on the belts, on the hoses, on the wires, all of those things. And so they just start to break down. And so to answer your first question, the easiest way for someone at an auction to know if it was law enforcement is they look at the registration of the vehicle. I mean, if you do a VIN decode and it says police utility interceptor, then it's obvious. But even on vehicles that weren't necessarily coded as, like, the VIN doesn't populate, I'll give you a great example. Orange County Sheriff Office is a customer of ours, and we're actually selling some of their vehicles right now. And the buyers at the auction are keen on the fact that it was law enforcement. Yeah. I think it would be less obvious for someone like Ponce Inlet if, for instance, the GMC Sierra, I believe, is a PD vehicle, if I'm not mistaken, but it's a civilian spec. So if we remove the logos from that same truck and sell it, I think most buyers would assume that it was actually more like a public works vehicle, which helps the town. You want it to be a civilian spec whenever possible.
And that's where I was going with the whole thing. And I understand we're not screaming, hopefully, down the street at 100 miles an hour,
right,
or 120 on the interstate. It's Ponce Inlet. So would you recommend...
100%.
Hang on.
Oh, sorry.
Could we squeeze a 60-year out of it instead of 5 years based upon our geographic location and the miles that we have in Ponce?
Yes. So I would talk to Chief Glazier and Chief Scales and kind of get their input on just kind of anecdotally from their officers to see if there are any kind of issues from, you know, from the front seat type of scenario. But yeah, I mean, I think that from a resale perspective and from, I think, 6 years, I think you could.
Okay.
But again, I would want to defer on the, you know, the use
but
of those
it's something
vehicles.
We can think about, I guess.
Yeah, and I'll actually give you an example. Belle Isle is kind of in a similar position as you. They're surrounded by the city of Orlando as well as Orange County Sheriff's Office, and so they don't do a lot of pursuit. And so their entire PD fleet is actually F-150 civilian specs. I don't want to put Chief Glazier on the spot, and I won't do that. But you know, perhaps that's something, you know, we could look at. Obviously, when an officer steps on the pedal, you need that truck to go.
Yes.
And so that's why I would defer to him and his team on that. But from a just purely financial perspective, if you could spec it in civilian spec, it would do better on the resale market.
And then last question for me. What got my attention about this is when I was meeting with Michael and Dan, and we were discussing the vehicle lease program, and then he said, well, we can also purchase new vehicles through them. I said, oh, didn't know that.
Yeah.
So that kind of piqued my interest because Dan and Mike, we generally talked, nothing, no presentation, but say we could potentially save money buying through them instead of the contracts that the state of Florida or whomever might have through Public Works or Public Safety. So that is a yes, correct?
That is yes. That is a yes. So
if we did that, and then once we decide to sell that vehicle, would we be allowed to utilize your resale team?
Yes. Exactly.
Purchase another. Okay, that answers that. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, it's actually becoming a kind of a popular option. You know, because understandably, people see, you know, interest rates and, you know, they're higher than they were 3-4 years ago. And, you know, and so they're wanting to have other options available. And in fact, we brought on a government agency this year that ordered 50 vehicles from us and they didn't lease a single one. And so, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm good. Thank you.
Thank you. Bill? Joe? Gary?
Yeah, I got just a quick, because we never talk about the cash flow. And the cash flow from the financial end is factored in somewhere about should we buy, should we lease, and we're talking leasing or we're talking purchasing. It's still trying to spread out the expense over multiple years so that the cash flow is somewhat even. And it doesn't go up and down, which is what can happen if you're actually purchasing for cash at that point. And I've never heard that discussed, whether that's good, bad, or indifferent, yeah, and whether it's worth discussing at all.
Yeah. Bill?
Just one thing. Being on the beach, the one thing I've learned living here for the last 25 years is no matter what we do, we have a major salt problem.
Yeah.
My concern is we were keeping the cars for 5 and 6 years and some 10, 12, 15 years, and they're not safe. And I'll give an example. It's happened twice to homeowners in our complex. They had a particular type of car. They leased them. It was a 5-year lease, and they leased them. At 3 years, the leasing company had to come with a trailer to put the car on the trailer to take it away because the car was no longer safe because of the salt, et cetera, and problems with the car. So I don't want us to do anything that we keep a car as long. I mean, I'm looking at we still have 11 cars from 2011 and 2012. Are they considered safe? What is our maintenance schedule on them? And that's why back in 2023, I was for the leasing because I can get rid of the car sooner. So that's what I'm looking at again. I'm looking at the cost factor, of course, but I'm also looking at the safety factor because one thing we're supposed to do is make sure our staff is safe.
Yeah.
So I'm going to listen to what everybody has to say before I make a decision.
Yeah, but, Bill, one thing on that is if we're in the maintenance program with them, we know what's going on. And that's what I'm saying. Even if we purchase the vehicle and we purchase it through Enterprise, we can be part of the maintenance program. And that way, again, as the maintenance program goes on, if there's issues with the vehicle, we understand at that time.
And that's what I'm looking at. I mean, when I can remember I had a car, I loved the car. It's a nice car. It had a SUV, and it had a window that opened up separately, and then it had a lid that opened up separately. The car was 5 years old. Yeah, 5 years old. And I opened up the lid one day, big monster lid on this big SUV, and it came off of my hands.
Oh, geez.
It had completely rusted out. The bolt had completely rusted out, and I'm holding this thing trying to not have it fall on me. And that's my concern. My concern is the safety. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure whatever we do, our people are going to be safe. So if like Kip said, that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
That makes sense to me, because how often do you go and check? I mean, I got a car now. It's 4 years old. 3 years, 2 years ago, I had to take it in and have a bolt on the door replaced because it completely rusted. I'm out 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
Well, and I think you illustrate the point that whether you choose to buy vehicles, whether you choose to lease vehicles, the most effective lease strategy is to have an in-service date and a predetermined out-of-service date. And stick to that and be disciplined.
Okay.
I've heard this said before by a customer, hope is not a strategy. And so if you buy a vehicle and hope that it can run for 10 years, that's not the same as actually having a plan. Now look, if 10 years ends up being the data and the data backs that up and you can do it for 10 years, absolutely. You just want to know what that time period is and you want to stick to that time period exactly to your point.
Well, and I agree with that, because I believe what we had hoped to do is create a consistent and manageable replacement plan. That's why we're here. We need to commit to something, and when I say commit, I mean just the concept.
Right.
Right. And in partnership with Enterprise, we have a number of options, and I think it's fair to say that really what we're looking for is something that's safe, we want to commit to it, and we want it to be the least expensive option for the town, understanding the cash flow aspect that you were talking about. So I forgot. I'm so sorry, Joe. Is there anything that you would like to add?
No. Everyone here knows that I'm a car guy. I've had 350 cars in the last 60 years. And I understand financing because I had to do it for a couple of years for Xerox Corporation. So I understand the concept, the cash flow, the age of the vehicle, the idle time, the salt, air contaminants, all of those things that go into aging a vehicle, and then the way it is utilized. So I think I'm in pretty good shape with understanding where we have to go.
Well, we're going to ask you your opinion then further of perhaps what direction, because it can be a hybrid approach.
Yes.
It depends on the vehicles themselves. So anyway, does anyone have any more questions of Jacob before I open it to the public? And does anyone on our staff wish to add anything at this time to our discussion?
No, we're good.
No? Okay. Yes, Mr. Fields.
Steve Fields, 6 Marzul. I apologize in advance. I don't completely understand. So who puts out, say it's a $40,000 vehicle, who puts out the $40,000 up front?
Well, if it's a lease, we would buy the vehicle and lease it back to the town.
And then you would charge a depreciation fee every month, which wasn't on the other slide.
Well,
can we go back to the other slide?
Depreciation is not a fee. Depreciation is simply going towards the principal of the vehicle.
It's cash flow to the city.
Of course.
So when you're talking about these lease charges per month, that's basically a management fee.
Correct.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure. So the bottom line is you management fee, a maintenance fee, and a depreciation fee you charge to the city every month.
Yes.
Okay, I'm a little slow, but...
No. Thank you. Thank you for clarifying that for everyone, Mr. Fields.
Yes.
And Mr. White.
Shannon White, 39 Coast Oaks. Was I correct in hearing correct that there was no down payment?
Yes, that is correct.
So when we leased all these vehicles a couple years ago, we didn't have any down payment on
them? That is correct.
Okay, that's good. And then this open-end lease, I was really astonished with that. What is the cost difference between an open-end lease and the term and I can't remember the first?
Oh, the walkaway lease?
All right.
So the walkaway lease, the best way to think about a walkaway lease is that's more like a rental almost because you have a set term and a set mileage. I don't know what that number is for each vehicle off the top of my head, but most cities don't do the walkaway lease because it looks good from a cash flow perspective.
Right, but it's very restrictive.
But you don't get any of the proceeds back, and it's a fixed term, and so you're required to turn the vehicle back in at that point. There's mileage restriction, there's wear and tear. And for most cities, especially if you're talking public works or parks and rec where they're throwing shovels in the back, you know, that would not be an appropriate lease. So the open-ended, the equity lease is a lot more flexible, and you don't have those same types of, mileage penalties or wear and tear or anything like that. So your folks can throw shovels in the back, and if they have to go off-road or whatever they have to do, and there's no penalty.
Okay. Well, I was just surprised at the fact that we had no mileage restrictions on those, too.
Yes, no mileage restrictions. This is really, it's set up to be, you know, government friendly, if you will, because we recognize, like, if all we were to offer would be walkaway leases, there just wouldn't be much of a market for it in this space because of the way you utilize vehicles. And so, by necessity, we set up, you know, this lease structure.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Yes, Sharon. Thank you for being here.
Hi. Sharon Lemieux, 4590 South Atlantic Avenue. You brought up a good point about safety and our salt and the wear and tear. My question is, I'm assuming that the town of Ponsonlet does not have a service garage, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. On that assumption, who is it responsible for the inspections of the vehicles daily, weekly, to continue the safety features of these settings vehicles?
That would be on the town.
All right. Is that put into place for these vehicles, or have they been put in place as far as a weekly or daily or monthly inspection of the vehicles?
Mike?
Yeah, the users inspect them. I mean, they drive them. They know what's going on. If there's a problem, then they identify that.
I'm thinking of something a little bit more proactive. A little known secret, I was a police officer for a large metropolitan area back in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And if and when a vehicle had an issue, it usually happened during service, which is not something you want to take. So if it is a personal responsibility for an officer to ensure that their vehicle is inspected daily, do you have a protocol?
Yeah. Chief, do you want to address that?
I'll sit down for my answer.
No, that's a great question. For police and fire and public works, they're inspected every day. There's a maintenance schedule, a routine maintenance schedule for oil changes and things along those lines. And the nice thing with the maintenance program that we have with Enterprise, there's pre-designated shops, actually shops that we've used in the past, that will also look at the vehicle when it comes in. And ironically, a lot of the times, shops are trying to upsell you for things that you really don't need. Enterprise has been very good at help minimize that. So we're repairing the vehicles when they need to be repaired. They're being inspected on a regular basis. And the nice thing is, because the officers and the users know if something's wrong with them, they're going to get fixed. They're a little bit more proactive in letting us know if there is a problem with the vehicle. So it's been a good program. So that's a great point, though. Yep.
Thank you, Dan. Is there anyone else? because now I'd like to actually go back to our Councilman Villanella if he has something with all his expertise that he'd like to share in terms of maybe a suggestion of moving forward. Because right now we do have to still address the two, this fiscal year ending, because we do have automobiles that we have to address. But in general, is there something that you would like to share with us?
No. When I look at a program like this, my overall approach to it, understanding of it, is I've been involved with this type of stuff over the many, many years that I've been on this earth. And this particular program for this town makes a lot of sense. And I don't really think there's any reason for us to back away from it. When you look at the cash flow aspects, as Gary has mentioned, when you look at the salt air contaminants, as Bill is talking about, and you look at the maintenance, ongoing maintenance and so forth that Skip has talked about, we have this nailed. So
does that mean then is that we're budgeting about $200,000 per year as each lease comes due?
It seems.
And continue that as a program?
It seems reasonable to me.
Okay, good. That's really what I wanted to know. Okay. Skip, okay. How do you feel?
Mine's going to be a little different, and I'm kind of surprised that I'm going to say this, but I actually see two types of programs with this, reason being with our public works, for example. You know, if and I don't hold me the exact number, but I think our buyout on the public works is like $20,000. We can get some more life out of those vehicles for us personally. Another 5 years, 10 years, Dan. I'm kidding. Another 5 years, so. But I see that as a benefit because it's a cost that comes out of our yearly budget because we can extend that on. And for getting another 4 to 5 years per vehicle for $20,000 makes a lot of sense to me. From the police vehicle side, and the reason I was asking the questions earlier was because my mind started going to this hybrid thing. If we turn those vehicles in 5 years, we get to recoup whatever monies that you guys generate. And I went back and listened to the tape from 2016.
Please do.
I did.
Oh, you did.
Okay. Oh, it was like 57 minutes, I think. But I went back and listened to it because I remember, and Chief got up and he talked about where it was Daytona, wasn't Daytona Beach Shores, it was South Daytona. Asked Chief at a luncheon why we weren't leasing vehicles because they turn theirs in every year, and their vehicle lease is actually paid for them for the next year, which I know it all depends upon the market.
Yes.
But that really stuck in my head. So I'm not saying we do that.
Right.
But I'm saying it kind of makes sense is if we can keep our police officers' fleet updated and recoup some of the money. Now, the last question I have before I get to that point, I'm going to call it your fee. I call it interest. What is that number percentage-wise? Because we had a resident that tackled me on the street one day because he said, do you realize we're paying 18% interest to Enterprise for these vehicles? I said, if they are, I'm going to start leasing the vehicle or selling the vehicles to the town, and I will make money. So my question is, and not holding you to an exact number, but it's not 18%.
No, sir. So our interest rate is, and it's a sourced well competitive bid process. So you can rest assured that nobody from the, it's not like we sit down locally and go, oh, let's pick an interest rate. It's all dictated by source well, but it's 3.5% above the 3-year T-bill.
Okay.
And so I don't remember exactly what it was when we delivered these leases, but it's probably in the neighborhood of 6.5 to 7.
You answered it.
Okay.
So, Mayor, again, I'm a hybrid, okay. And I'm a for public safety.
Right.
And then for public works, we purchase the vehicles we have as they come off lease, and we continue to utilize the program either through Enterprise or someone else. I have to say that.
Understood.
By law, I have to say that. So that's where I'm at.
Okay. And the public safety vehicles, what do you want with
them? The public safety vehicles leased.
Right.
But the public works vehicles we purchase.
At the time the lease ends.
That's correct.
Okay. So that's a hybrid approach. I'll go back to Joe to see if that's acceptable to you. But, Bill, how do you feel?
That's exactly what
that's
I wanted.
That's what you were going to, yes. I like the hybrid. Are you comfortable with that, Joe?
That's logical. Yeah, I have no problem with that.
You're good.
Purchasing.
Gary?
Well, basically, yes, but I would like to ask a question of the people using these vehicles.
Okay.
The police department, the fire department, the public works. They've seen both systems from a day-to-day operational issue. Which one do they prefer?
Can we ask our public safety director to come up and see if he's able to respond to that? You can't respond to it, can you? I'm not sure if you can.
I will follow the council's direction is what I will do. In all honesty, I think the hybrid model does
Makes
work
sense.
Well.
Mm-hmm.
And our relationship with Enterprise is really analogous to our relationship with our insurance broker.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every year we sit down with our insurance broker to look at the best plans. When we sit down and look at our fleet replacement strategy, we sit down with them and look at the market to make sure that we're buying what we should be buying, when we're buying it, and selling it when we should be selling it. So I think a hybrid approach is a good fit.
Yes, I do as well. Okay.
With
so,
that?
Yeah. Okay. And those are the – that would be – Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to ask anything before you? Yes, Liz.
Liz Caswell, 4744 South Peninsula. In terms of the cash flow, probably our better bet here is to take a bigger perspective in terms of what's happening with the economy. GMC and Ford are not entirely made in the United States, and we will be relying on some international parts, as will Enterprise or anybody else who maintains our fleets going forward. We will have increased tariffs in terms of not only parts, but we ought to be thoughtful about the kinds of cars that we are bringing into our fleet for those reasons. In terms of the cash flow situation, the town of Ponce Inlet does not have a cash flow situation that would preclude us from participating in that third program, where we buy it up front and then we go ahead and use perhaps Enterprise's maintenance program or some other vendor's maintenance program in order to maintain that fleet. The other good idea that you had there, I think, Skip, is around using perhaps a six-year window, looking and seeing if a six-year window for those vehicles could be good for those that we do need to lease, to see if we can get, that's a 20% increase, improvement, if you will, before we have to buy a new vehicle. If we ask our employees what their opinions are about the vehicles versus the old vehicles, I'm going to, dollars to donuts, say they like the new ones better. Right? Everybody likes that new experience. But I do think we should look at buying the vehicles up front if we do decide to go a hybrid approach. I like the approach, but do buy the vehicles up front. And we also, the other thing we need to consider is that Enterprise is making a fair amount of dollars on us. It's not just those interest payments that you see there. It's in the reselling as well, and they say that we get some of that profit back. That profit is based upon numbers that are shared at the time of contract implementation, not at the time of the market value of the used car market, which continues to rise. Thank you.
Thank you, Liz. Is there anyone else?
Way back there.
Yes.
Craig Sandman, 37 Ocean Way Drive, Ponce Inlet. I've been in the transportation industry for 44 years. Thank goodness I've been retired for 10. The thing to keep in an aircraft or a truck or a tug or anything is the maintenance involved. Not just changing oil, but doing everything. I've been at places where they would wash the trucks every week. They would take care of everything every week. They'd have a big maintenance schedule, not just the oil, not just putting in fluid for the windshield washer. So you almost need, if you're going to buy a car, if you're going to purchase it, you need a place and a schedule to take care of it. That means the locks, you have to spray it. You have to take care of it if you live by the ocean. I've been in planes that you're being 10 years old, and they seem like they're brand new. I've been in planes at companies that were 3 years old, and they're ready to go to the boneyard already. So it depends on how you set it up, the maintenance, and a really good schedule, and keep to it. That's all.
Thank you. Are we ready to move forward with instructions? I think, do you have enough from us to move forward?
Do.
You do. Excellent. Jacob, thank you. You were so helpful. I thank the council for their review of all of this and the input, and thank you to the public. I think we have a good plan moving forward.
Thanks.
Thank you, Jacob. Thank you, everyone. Okay.
Yeah, thank you, council. Thanks for Councilman White for bringing this back. Now we have clear direction. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Okay. Now we are at item 8B, the results. We're going to look at the 2025 Ponce Inlet Employee Classification and Compensation Study. Kim? I don't think you're on.
On now?
Yes.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mayor and Council members. I am here to introduce a classification and compensation study. This study is part of the Town Council's GOLD for the Human Resource Department, which was adopted by Resolution 20-2403 in January of 2024. The town's last classification and compensation salary study was completed in 2016. Since then, surrounding municipalities have updated their pay structures, and some have implemented or implementing longevity-based pay, which is going to be leaving us in a competitive disadvantage. The average tenure of a town employee is 5.5 years, or the median is 3.25. A salary study will assist the town with remaining competitive in recruitment and retains experienced employees. Why is a salary study needed? The town has experienced high turnover rates in the last 5 years, with the loss of 59 employees, which is an average of 12 employees per year, equaling a 19% turnover rate. A salary study would help with attracting and training, retaining qualified staff, keeping competitive compensation, and will help provide pay equity while addressing compression. Okay. Here's an annual breakdown of the last 5 years. Fiscal year 23-24, well, let me start from the bottom. Fiscal year 2019-20, we had a 26% turnover rate, with 15 employees out of 58 that left. Fiscal year 2021 was a 25% turnover rate, with 15 employees out of 60 leaving. 21-22 was an 8% turnover, with only 5 employees leaving out of 62 employees. 22-23 has a 13% turnover rate, where 9 employees out of 64 left, causing an estimated productivity loss of $135,000. 23-24 had a 21% turnover rate, where 15 out of 72 left, which also made an estimated productivity loss of $230,000. Over the past 5 years, a total of 59 employees have left, resulting in an estimate productivity loss of just over $725,000. Or you can just look at the last 2 years, and it is estimated at $365,000. What contributes to the cost of turnover? Recruitment, advertising, time to fill, cost to hire, the training, the replacement, the loss of institutional knowledge, community relationships, disruption to some services, organizational stability. These costs rise significantly higher when replacing a specialized position, mid or upper level positions. Why add longevity pay? It's a motive incentive, typically a very small percentage on the years of service. Rewards loyalty and long-term commitment, preserves your institutional knowledge, internal and external relationships, provides a competitive advantage with our neighboring municipalities, addresses pay compression fairly and consistently. The longevity that is being proposed is a one-time adjustment for the years of service, starting with an employee's second year of service at 1% and ending at 6% for 16 years and above. As you can see from our graph, that 55 employees, or 76 of the town's entire workforce, has been here less than 6 years. Some municipalities within Volusia County that are offering longevity pay: New Smyrna Beach pays in 5-year increments. Daytona Beach Shores pays an annual longevity bonus based on the years of service. And Volusia County pays longevity pay for retention of keeping employees. There are other municipalities within Florida that are also using longevity pay as a retention tool. Some of the strategic benefits for implementing the salary and longevity pay study: retention, lowers the cost of turnover; stability, ensures continuation of services; fairness, rewards commitment in transparent and consistent way; competitiveness, helps the town remain attractive to as an employer of choice. In conclusion of my part of this, the town has not completed a salary survey in nearly 10 years. It has been on the town's gold list since January of 2024. Turnover is costly in terms of loss of productivity. Some surrounding municipalities are offering longevity pay. The town currently does not. Implementing a salary survey with longevity pay included is a strategic investment that would save the town funds in the long term, strengthens our workforce, and assist with preserving our institutional knowledge. At this point, I would like to turn it over to Rachel Scraggs, Director of Human Capital Solutions at MGT Impact Solutions, LLC. Rachel and her team have been working closely with us on the study, and she will walk you through the methodology, the findings, and the recommendations in more detail. So, without far ado, here is Rachel Scraggs. Please, we are going to mute ourselves, so if there's any questions, wait till the entire presentation is over, please. Okay? Because otherwise there's a lot of feedback. So, welcome, Rachel.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Great. Thank you. I'm going to share my screen, and I have a short presentation that I'll walk through and then be happy to answer any questions after that. Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Rachel Scaggs. I am a director of human capital with MGT, and I've been with MGT for almost 6 years now, and all of my work with MGT is with classification and compensation studies, only working with public sector organizations, counties, cities, townships, all municipalities, also special service areas, and not-for-profits as well. Prior to working with MGT, I spent 10 years in local government management. Most recently, I was the city manager for a community in Illinois called Princeton, Illinois, which is where I currently reside. And prior to my time as a city manager, I worked for a couple of communities in the Chicago suburbs as an assistant. So really looking forward to talking to you today about the classification and compensation study that we did for the town. This is a little agenda of what I'll be going over. I'm going to talk about what was included within the scope of work. I'll focus on the job evaluation, which really leads to the classification plan. I'll talk about the market survey, the proposed compensation plan. I'll go over some general recommendations on implementation of the plan and also the future administration of the system, and then we'll have plenty of time for questions. I always like to start off with, why complete a classification and compensation study? over my 6 years of working on classification and compensation studies, I myself have probably completed over 200, and as a team, we've done well over 500 classification and compensation studies. And I think there's kind of two components. On the classification side, it's really important because it creates that internal hierarchy, that internal pay fairness, and supports career progression for employees. They see a clear path of where they can go and what the pay is for those positions. And then likewise on the external analysis and the compensation side, that really incorporates the market competitiveness, making sure that there's current data that's being used, current market data to develop those pay plans. This is a list of the scope of work that was included in this process, and I'll go over some of these in detail on the coming slides. But we first held study preparation and project meetings. We determined a group of comparable entities. And one thing that's really important in our process is making sure that we include employees. And so we held an employee kickoff meeting. There was a market survey that was sent out to those comparable entities. All of that was analyzed. We completed the job evaluation, put together a draft classification and compensation plan and a report. And that is what we're making a presentation on now. And again, I'll go over a lot of what I just mentioned in further detail on the coming slides. So the first part was the job evaluation. We looked at 48 positions, and each position is reviewed using the same 9 job factors, and that's really what creates that internal fairness amongst positions within the town. So we looked at education. What are the required preparation and training needed to perform the job? Work experience, the years of experience needed to perform the job. The level of decision-making and independent judgment that the position has. The responsibility for policy development, but also implementation and interpretation of policies and procedures. Planning of work, so is the position planning their own work or the work of others? We looked at the level of contact each position has, so both internal and external contact, and that's with, you know, residents, visitors, businesses, vendors, contractors, all of their contacts internally and externally, also with other governmental entities and things like that. We looked at work of others, so the supervision that is exercised by that position, the working conditions, which include unpleasant hazardous conditions and also physical demands, and then use of technology or specialized equipment. So every employee completed a job analysis questionnaire that looks at those 9 factors. From there, supervisors were able to provide comments on the JAQ. However, we always say don't make any changes to what the employee has filled out. We like to understand how the employee views the position. Supervisors are able to provide comments. Everything comes back to us at MGT, and then we look holistically at that completed job analysis questionnaire and the job description. And then we also take it a step further and conduct virtual one-on-one interviews with at least one employee in each position. And that just allows us to really understand the position and what they're doing for the town. We work with a lot of different communities, and, you know, job titles might be the same, but every community, the functions of that specific job are a little bit different. So it's really important that we meet with every position and really understand the duties of their position and the roles of their job in the community. We also make it very clear up front during that initial kickoff meeting, we're not looking at performance or, you know, someone's the position or the person in the position. We're really looking at the position and what are the minimum requirements for that job. So after that is completed, that job evaluation, we put together the classification plan, and that really focuses on the internal fairness and how positions relate to one another within the town. Table 1, which I'll pull up shortly, shows the classification plan. There's 12 grades, and every position is within one of those 12 pay grades. The second component to the study is the external market analysis and review. So the first step in that is determining a group of comparable peers or comparable entities. This is included as Appendix B, but we first look at the following 8 criteria. So population, per capita income, median value of owner-occupied housing, total primary government expenditures, property tax revenue, full-time employees, full-time salaries paid for 1 month, and proximity. So we look at communities that are most similar based on these eight criteria. The more points a community receives means the more similar they are. So for instance, for population, a community that's 1.5 times less or more of Ponce Inlet, the more points they're going to receive. The farther out that gets, the less points those communities are going to receive. And that's really to help us come up with similar entities that have a similar ability to pay. So we established a cutoff of 55 points, and there were 16 communities that achieved 55 or more points on that scale. And so they were the most similar based on those criteria and based on their ability to pay. We also recommend three additional comparables that were similar in terms of services and location. And then there were 14 additional entities that have been used by the town as comparables in the past, and they're also competitors in the marketplace, which I think is a second component when we look at comparables, because you might have similar ones that have the same ability to pay, but where are you really losing your talent to? Who are the competitors in the marketplace? And also, where would you recruit talent from? So there was a total of 33 comparables that were used, and you can see those listed here on this slide. The ones that are bolded are the ones that responded to the salary survey or supplied us with a copy of their compensation data and plans. All of the data that's collected is collected through the use of a salary survey. So we put together that market survey. Each position is defined to make sure that we're gathering accurate data. Again, you know, some towns might have similar jobs, but the job title might be a little bit different. So it's important to define that position so that when they're reviewing that, they can make accurate salary matches. We review everything that's received to make sure it's appropriate for the position. We also prefer to look at salary ranges. So in some instances, towns might have provided us with ranges and actual salary data, but we really don't focus too heavily on the actuals unless we don't have enough range data. Ranges are really a better gauge of what the market is for the position, looking at the minimum and maximum ranges and understanding what the market is. When you look at actuals, a lot of different things can go into those, such as bonuses or longevity or anything like that. So we look at the range data, and that's the market for the position. All of the data that we gathered is current for the positions because it's been gathered over the last couple of months. And it's important to note that benefits was not included as part of this study. However, I always like to highlight that, you know, I probably do benefits in maybe half of the studies that I complete, and overwhelmingly within the public sector, benefits are always found to be very comparable from one organization to the next because, again, working in the public sector previously and then now working with many communities, we find that the benefits are very comparable and competitive from one community to the next. There might be a few little differences, but nothing too significant. Overall, they're very similar. So I just wanted to note that. After the market data is collected, we put together the proposed compensation plan. So again, looking at all of those positions and the grades that they fell in, we then look at the compensation data and the market data for each position. All of the compensation rates are calculated at the 50th percentile of the salaries of the communities that we surveyed. When we talk about the 50th percentile, that is really the median. That's the market for the positions. We would never recommend a pay plan that's below the 50th percentile because then that would mean you're paying your employees below market. So the 50th percentile is really the baseline, the market for the positions. Sometimes we have clients who want to be payers above the 50th percentile and they might choose the 60th or 70th. But for this study, we have calculated rates at the 50th percentile. So the pay ranges and pay plans have also been calculated at the 50th percentile. And you'll see that there's those 12 grades, one being the lowest and 12 being the highest. All proposed pay ranges are open ranges, meaning there's not a defined step increment. It's from the minimum to the maximum. There's a 40% range spread. And there's also a 10% gradation from one grade to the next within each pay band. And then overall, when I looked at where your current ranges are and how it relates to the market, there's some that need adjustments. And overall, the average was about a 5,000 adjustment in the minimum from where you currently are to what the market is showing for those positions. And here, I wanted to show an example right here. So you can see I just pulled some positions out of there. They're in different grades. We have that collective market data at the 50th percent percentile. So this is the market data for the positions. You can see where your current ranges are, and then you can see what we're proposing for each of those positions. And I think this just helps show, you know, what areas you can see that are falling just a little bit behind and what our recommendation is for those positions. Also, within ranges, we recommend a consistent range spread. So it's never going to match perfectly with the market because all of your peers have different spreads, 30, 40, 50%. So we always recommend a consistent range spread and try to match it with the market as closely as we can. And then once the plan is approved and you're looking at implementation, we kind of recommend these three things. So first, anyone who's below the minimum of the proposed compensation should be brought to the minimum as soon as possible. And there are some that are affected by that. I think that's on the next slide. I'll go through the positions that are falling below the minimum. So they should be raised to the minimum as soon as possible. The compensation of employees who are within the range, you don't have to make any adjustments outside of the optional longevity adjustment that we'll get to. And then if there was anyone that was falling outside of the maximum, we never recommend a pay cut. We say they should stay there until the market catches up. So again, there is also that longevity adjustment that's optional. Over all of the position, the average longevity adjustment would be 2%. And you'll see that specific percentages listed here based on the employee's years of service with the town. And again, that's an optional recommendation for you to consider. This list here shows the positions that are falling below the market minimum. I think there's 15 total. There's two maintenance tech one positions. So 14 listed here plus the two maintenance tech ones bring it to 15 total positions that are falling below that market minimum. And then once the plan is put into place, it's really important. We want this to be something that you can use for many years and update as needed and be really a flexible tool that you can continue to use and monitor for many years without having to do a full classification and compensation. You might want to do a compensation study again, but the classification should really have a strong structure and foundation. So on the classification side going forward, it's important to just look at those positions annually and respond to any changing conditions. So maybe there's a position that has taken on a bunch of additional duties, or maybe two part-time positions have become a full-time position, and you need to make sure it's still in the correct grade. We've provided those tools where you can create, adjust, or eliminate classifications as you need to going forward. We also provide service and help with that from a year once the study is complete. So we're available to help with those changes as well. And then on the compensation side, again, you don't have to do a full survey every year to your comparable peers, but it's important to understand what type of COLA increases they're giving and making sure that you're adjusting the ranges and moving employees through those ranges based on that annually. So again, you don't have to do a full study, but it's important to look at both the classification and compensation every year and make adjustments as needed. So that wraps up the presentation. Sometimes I know it's helpful to go through some other documents, but maybe I'll pause for a second and see what type of questions there are, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
So what I would suggest is that we should ask the specific questions, get your answers, and then as a council we'll begin our discussions, okay? Not a discussion when we're interacting with the questions. Just get answered what you need answered, and then we'll talk, okay? So, Joe, do you have any questions?
Actually not. I had read through this whole proposal, the whole thing, very diligently.
But no questions for Rachel at the moment?
No.
Okay. Skip?
Yes, ma'am. Hi. How are you? I'm Skip. I have a few. The longevity, you said again, that was not a classification factor, correct?
Correct.
Correct. Not. We just look at base salary, where the position should be based on the market at their base salary. Longevity is kind of additional, and that's after the fact. So we placed all the positions within the grades based on the market, came up with proposed market ranges based on that, and then the longevity would be specific to the employees.
Okay. The next question, again, you guys came up with the comparable communities. You came up with 16 communities using 8 criteria, your category, excuse me, plus you had 3 additional. Pons Inlet came in and put up another 14. So in your opinion, would that not skew your